Okay, yesterday we left off talking about, we ended with B'nai David, and we were talking about the, not B'nai David, sorry, we were talking about Anshei Emes, we were talking about the move to Fairfax, and the shift out of Boyle Heights and into the Fairfax community, or to West Adams, specifically. I want to talk about Judaism in the 50s first. You have to understand Judaism in the 50s to understand Los Angeles Orthodoxy in the 50s as a whole. If you asked people in the 20s and 30s, and then the 40s, what is the future for Judaism in any major city, in any suburb, it didn't look great. Religion was on its way out. That's true of any religion in America. It was beginning, traditionalism was beginning to fall away. The walls were beginning to crumble down. There was a book that was written in 1966, Harvey Cox, called The Secular City. That was a very important book because any traditional walls that were still up in the 50s, which gave off that image of a very wholesome place, that was beginning to fade away. You had the adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, and shows like that perpetuated the thought that everything is perfect in the world right now. Everything is hunky-dory, and it's safe, and it's you know, non-threatening. And the reruns perpetuated it long past those years. But the truth was, everything was coming apart, and the decade of chaos, which is the 60s and ultimately the 70s, were coming rapidly. And you have the fabric of religion that's beginning to fall apart. And you have what's the moral and intellectual revolution around that time. Eisenhower talks about a period of people complacent in their religiosity. No one's progressing. There's no new movements. Nothing's changing. That's the period you're entering to right now when you get to Los Angeles in the 50s. For many people, the 50s represent the end of something. We're not sure what, but the 50s are the end of something for a lot of people. You can trace that very clearly. The shift, when you look at even yearbooks between the 50s and the 60s, it's a whole other world. There is significant break or breakdown in the story of religion in America as you end the 1950s. One historian called it the last modern decade in religion was the 50s. No one imagined that the 80s and the 90s would bring about the revolution that it was going to bring about on all areas, with Russian Jewry, with all denominations and at all levels. Judaism was going to make a tremendous revival in just a span of 20 or 30 years. So by the way, and when they look at these numbers of conservative Judaism falling off the face of the globe, I say it doesn't mean much, because when you look at what Orthodoxy did when it was supposed to be gone, a religious movement can shift within 20 years. A pivotal movement can happen within 20 years. And all these polls and all this trying to analyze the Pew Report, they're important and they're great, but there's so many factors that you simply cannot predict. And it's what made Judaism very tricky in the 50s. And we talked about how Rabbi Zilberstein in Los Angeles tried to develop a Judaism that was sustained by the Shul Judaism. And the youth aligned themselves with B'nai Akiva, the youth aligned themselves with perhaps Anshei Emes, but there wasn't much yet. The shul might not have been enough. And that's what the purpose of today is to talk about, is that there was a realization by some great pioneers here in LA that the shul is not enough. The shul is not going to create continuity for the Jewish people. It's going to bring people through the doors, but it's revolving doors, unless we do something to keep people within the fold. It's going to need something more significant. This is an interesting time, the 50s. To round out the 50s, it's the uneasy time of the witch hunts and communism are coming to an end. Los Angeles turns its attention to recovery and good times. It's the times of Frisbee and hula hoop. And the biggest thing of all is Disneyland opening up in Anaheim in 1955. It becomes what LA becomes, a metaphor for wholesome, you know, good, wholesome family fun. Frontierland, Tomorrowland. Now all they need is a baseball team. 1957, they get the Brooklyn Dodgers. Brooklyn Dodgers come out to Los Angeles. And a building boom in the 1960s with the relaxation of height restrictions adds a lot of new high buildings here in Los Angeles, developments that are going to affect the development of Hillel and Beth Jacob, which we'll get to shortly. The other end was suffering miserably, you should know. The Jews lived here in a somewhat of a ghetto. The other end was suffering. You have in August 1965, right, you have an incident with a white policeman and a black a black individual arrested for drunk driving, which led to ultimately the Watts riots, where social questions come to the forefront. They're not going to change. They're going to be very contentious until you get Mayor Tom Bradley later on. That's the background of where we're at in Los Angeles. I want to take one more tangent till we get to tonight's topic, and that is the only part I'm going to talk about in the Valley, and that's the creation of Shaarei Tzedek. Because Shaarei Tzedek in the Valley as a Jewish community really begins to develop right at the same time, right at the beginning of the 1950s. We have minute-to-minute notes of every single thing that happened in Shaarei Tzedek's history. I don't know of any other shul that kept minute-to-minute notes like we have of Shaarei Tzedek. And that's all due to a man by the name of Mr. Teddy Cohn, whose brother Paul Cohn davens by me over at Yavna. So he's kept everything. Every bulletin, every announcement, every detail, every meeting is kept in a journal. Multiple journals. So it starts with 1951. Memorial Day 1951, a group of families gathered in Irving K. Cohn's home to forge an Orthodox congregation. They contacted the Orthodox Rabbinical Associations and how they would go about doing this. They suggest different candidates. The Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations sent Rabbi Nathan Esterson to this group. Rabbi Nathan Esterson is the one who suggested the name Shaarei Tzedek. And they adopt the name because of him. That's what they're going to call the congregation. Rabbi Esterton begins conducting high holiday service for free. They don't have anything yet. Right, and he's going to start off working for free, and you have one of the most famous shul presidents in LA, Irving Cohn, who stays on as president for those early years in the first 3 years. You have the first full-time rabbi is Rabbi Eugene J. Grunberger, who's famous for one thing, Rabbi Grunberger, particularly. You remember him, you know?
Yes, sure.
Okay.
I remember Esterson also.
So he comes up in a 1971 article in the Los Angeles Times. Why? Because Ronald Reagan develops a plan to dismiss 3 full-time Jewish chaplains. One of them is going to be Rabbi Grunberger. He's going to be dismissed as a full-time chaplain. It was to cut costs here in the city and the state at large. So he makes it into the Los Angeles Times. They go through another rabbi. The rabbis, you know, sort of are leaving quickly in the Valley. They don't see too much of a future yet. The next rabbi is Rabbi Aaron Shapiro, hired in 1958. Nathan Solomon is their famous chazan. They hire in 1958. Beth Jacob Naim, or Errol Korchak is the president in 1959 and then 1960. He's the one who's going to hire probably the most famous name in the Valley until you get to the 70s, and that's Rabbi Gilbert Shoham. Rabbi Gilbert Shoham, a student of Rav Soloveitchik, getting smicha from Ritz, he's going to start Emek, the school in the Valley as well. So he's a pivotal figure when we speak about the rabbinate in Los Angeles, where Los Angeles was. He's going to leave Shaarei Tzedek as well. He's going to become a famous rabbi in Overland Park, Kansas, which at that time has a strong Jewish community. Let's now move out of the Valley and come to us. 1925, and we're talking about, this is Boyle Heights is still moving right now. This is Boyle Heights in its heyday. But 33 people decide that Jews who lived in the West Adams section needed a shul with a Talmud Torah and a social center close to their homes. This small group chooses the name West Adams Hebrew Congregation. West Adams Hebrew Congregation. 1928, the congregation dedicates its first building. Originally, it was organized as a conservative synagogue. It then evolves into what's known as a semi-Orthodox or a traditional Orthodox synagogue over the years. The synagogue begins to grow. Their first rabbi is not what people think is Rabbi Dolgan. The first rabbi of this West Adams iteration, whatever you want to call it, is Rabbi Nathan Adelson, who's there from 1933 to 1938. It's in 1938 where they get their newly trained rabbi from the Hebrew Theological College of Chicago, which is going to, that by the way, is going to produce 4 All-Stars in L.A. It's going to produce Rabbi Dolgan, who we're going to talk about momentarily. It's going to produce Rabbi Summers. It's going to produce Rabbi Levine, Judea, which becomes B'nai David Judea through a merger. And number 4, anybody knows the 4th, famous? He's here now, Rabbi Fassman. Rabbi Fassman is the 4th. That's a good trivia. On the game show, they're going to ask you, who are the 4 major figures in L.A. that came from the Chicago? What? The yeshiva, the Skokie yeshiva, as they call it. So you have 1949, Beth Jacob establishes its own day school, which is, we're going to be called Hillel in a moment. 1954, Rabbi Dolgan decides we're moving out of West Adams into a new area, uncharted territory. Certainly for Orthodox Jewry, we're moving to Beverly Hills, an exclusive area. When he moved them to Beverly Hills, he not only moved the synagogue geographically, he moved the synagogue spiritually. And in a famous presentation as he moved the synagogue, he said, I want a machitza here in the shul. The board met together and said, Rabbi, we're going to have a vote. Rabbi Dolgan turned to them and said, we're going to have a vote. You're voting on whether you're having a rabbi or not going forward. We're not voting on the mechitza, which is a fascinating statement, and which early on he was coined the name Little Caesar. We're going to see that name pops up in newspapers, is the name he is dubbed. And by those closest to him, I thank Mr. Bernie Malamed, who really was a Talmud of Rav Dolgan, who shared with me much of this, much of the information that I have from Rav Dolgan, along with UCLA archives had tons of stuff on Rabbi Dolgan and also the family members. In 1955, Beth Jacob's day school changes its name to Hillel Hebrew Academy. It moves in 1964 into a new block, into a new location, right where we are today. Into a new a little bit over, this is new, down the block from where we are today. 1955, they change its name. 64, they merge with a local congregation, Beth Jacob, with B'nai Israel. 1971, Rabbi Dolgan makes Aliyah to Ramat Eshkol, starts a shul in Ramat Eshkol called, anybody know the name?
Beth Jacob.
Beth Jacob is the name of the shul in Ramat Eshkol. So I could tell you the history just like that, and you probably could find it somewhere on a Beth Jacob website on the About section. But let's get into what really happened here. How we get to Beth Jacob and Hillel, and who some of the major pivotal players were as we get to its history. Rabbi Dolgan was no small individual, although they called him Little Caesar. He was larger than life. And I'm going to show you three facets to Rabbi Dolgan's personality. Number one is the universal larger than life Rabbi Dolgan. I have a collection of letters given to me by his son. A collection of letters, a correspondence. I won't let you know yet who it's to. Who are the correspondents between? Here he goes. He writes as follows. Adoni Hayakar, my precious, sir. I'll give away the next word.
Rabbi Gottesman.
No. Oh. Rosh HaMemshala.
Oh.
David Ben-Gurion. I'm writing to you, I'm giving myself permission to write to you about a problem that bothers me from the establishment of Medinat Yisrael. You're very busy to be busy with individual letters, specifically busy with letters of things that are bothering individuals specifically. However, it could be, but I think you could help solving this problem. Right? Ani chai begola ba'artzot habrit. I live in the gola in Artzot habrit in America. Right? I and the majority of the Yehudim Amerikayim are going to be here for a while and have been here for a while. Right? And we're also hoping that many of our children and grandchildren will stay Americanim. Will stay Americans. It's going to be funny. He's going to make Aliyah along with his family. Right? Vizohi habaya. That's the problem we have over here. What he raises is the great problem of the Zionist in diaspora. The conflict that the Zionist in diaspora faces. You want to contribute and you feel you can make a difference in the world that you're in. You feel that your place and your support, one should be loyal to their host country, their host nationality. But you also have an allegiance to Israel. Right? Dolgan raised the other issue. We can probably better support Israel, knowing that Israel has support on the outside. So how do we solve this dilemma, this conflict that we face within us? Leman Yahadut Mu'uchedet, for the purpose of a united Judaism. Teach us. Leman Hakel, for God. Yisrael, the Torah. I'm asking for your advice. How do we resolve this existential conflict? Answers the Rosh HaMemshala. He takes the letter seriously. Not only does he take the letter seriously, they're going to engage in a back and forth for 9 letters. 9 correspondences back and forth. He first apologizes like a gedolim responsa. He apologizes why he didn't get a chance to write sooner. He's been so, tarud, busy with everything. He says, Ani onelecha ivrit. I'm going to answer you in Hebrew because I see, right, that it's not a foreign language to you. Right? It's not a foreign language to you, and I'm going to answer you. And if I make a mistake with you, please pardon me. Right? If there's some mistake that happens lost in translation, excuse me. And this letter, he says, is the importance of collecting the strongest Jews that we can in the land of Israel. Israel is not strong enough yet, says Ben-Gurion, to stand on its own. We'll worry about support from the outside when we get there. But right now, it needs all of you, and it needs everyone. And it's amazing, this back and forth between them. I'm not interested in the details as much as I am the fact that this correspondence happened. The one of its kind that we know of, certainly, from here in Los Angeles. So Rabbi Dolgin, you're dealing with no longer, you have to understand, the concept of a shtetl rav, you know, a rav who is busy in his own dalet amos, and, you know, whether the chicken was kosher or not, Rabbi Dolgin is showing that the modern world has begun. We are now past that stage. We are back in the world, so to speak, where the Abarbanel had contact with, you know, King Ferdinand. We're back to those stages where Rabbi Dolgin is understanding that Judaism and the rabbinic can come out of its shell and can now be involved in the modern world, can now make a difference in the modern world. I want to share with you another facet to Rabbi Dolgin's personality and Rabbi Dolgin as the Shul Rabbi. His speeches. A major theme for Rabbi Dolgin in his speeches was the concept of heritage, right? A morasha. Morasha kihilas Yaakov, right? The congregation of Jacob, maybe Beit Yaakov, right, is a morasha. It's a heritage. It's an heirloom. It's not an inheritance. It's a yerusha. A morasha is a heritage, an heirloom that's passed along and needs to be cared for. And he says a very important point, which the family said he used to hammer home over and over. The only positive way to look at Jewish heritage is as a faith in a destiny guided by God, that we are chosen in His charge, chosen to let survive, with a faith that God has led the Jews where they are today and has a mission for us tomorrow. The concept that we are part of a great chain of tradition and God, and meaning Jews in history. Why is this important? This is important because he's forming a congregation. Later on, when we're going to get to the Rabbi Maurice Lamb era, where you have Jews at Beth Jacob joining the protest for the, you know, saving Jews, freeing Jews from communist Russia, and different causes of bringing Jews out of Ethiopia, you have to understand, Rabbi Dolgin already wired the congregation to think in broader historical terms. The average mindset of somebody davening in their local little shtiebel was, I go to my shtiebel, I go home, I have my Shabbos meal, I do work during the week, I try to get my kids some Jewish education, and I'm done. Rabbi Dolgin was changing the entire paradigm of the rabbinate. We're going to begin thinking of our role in the greater destiny of the Jewish people. That's a huge shift in Judaism in Los Angeles. You understand this? This was beginning to happen in New York already, but as far as Los Angeles Judaism is concerned, that's a game changer, because now instead of looking at your Judaism as this little thing connected to a few yentas down the block, my Judaism is now much bigger. It's connected to a worldwide religion, and there's pride in that. And that fuses the congregation with a tremendous amount of pride. Being a public figure that Rabbi Dolgin was, it was also an outspoken and engaging the people in a broader world. You see, a shtiebel rabbi also stays out of trouble. Doesn't speak about anything besides what the Parsha says and what the Yontif, the Omer, and let's go home. Rabbi Dolgin is speaking out, which means controversial subjects are going to come up. And that's going to create somewhat of a conflict. That's why you have in some of the newspapers at the time, the Jewish press, which was extremely anti-Orthodox when you talk in the 1960s. It's amazing how, you know, things happen. But the Jewish press, which was anti-Orthodox 1961, on top header, hundreds, including other rabbis, condemn the hatchet man, Rabbi Simon Dolgin, right? The hatchet man, Rabbi Solgin Dolgin. Storms of protest. Rabbi Dolgin was outspoken about conservative Judaism. That was the battleground in the 60s. If I would speak about conservative Reform Judaism in my shul now, they'd think I'm crazy. What are you talking about? There's no more battle anymore. There isn't a battle anymore. We're not fighting about that anymore. We're fighting to keep people Jewish. We're fighting to keep kids connected. We're fighting to keep people safe in this world. The battleground, the Reform, conservative Orthodox, it's a fight that doesn't exist now. But in the 60s, it was alive. It was real. And Rabbi Dolgin, in one speech, refers to conservative and Reform Jews. He calls them goyim. And once the Jewish press hears that, they go to town. And article after article, week after week, more in editorial. Why stop? More about Little Caesar from the publisher, Lee Sobel. He goes through long articles, but just trying to nail him for every little thing. What he's done politically, trying to ostracize people from the reform movement and this and that. And they're really going after him. You notice if some of the better why am I doing this, by the way? Why hasn't somebody done this before me? You know why? Because the major historians in L.A. at some point cut off Orthodoxy from their history books. They stopped. And I've been trying to figure out why. And I was looking at when this break happens, because they mentioned some of the early rabbis. They mentioned Rabbi Moses Feldman. They mentioned Rabbi Jacob Baum. But they stop. Once you get to the 60s, 70s, 80s, in all the L.A. Jewish history books, the good ones, they stop mentioning the Orthodox rabbis. It's as though it's just Rabbi Magnin, and then you get to Rabbi Wolpe, and everybody else is just the small potato. The Orthodox means nothing. Why? And I think there was a battle that we're forgetting about that was waged on the rabbinic front at the time, where some of the Orthodox rabbis were more outspoken, at least the ones of the bigger shuls, were more outspoken about the different denominations. And I think for that, they were sort of deleted from these other books, or it could just be that the other movements did not, or those who are writing the books are looking at it from a different vantage point. I'm not sure. It's just a theory. A couple stories to let you know about the personality of Rabbi Dolgan. Joe Simon was in real estate, and he was a vice president here at Beth Jacob. He was a hard-hitting guy, but also the reputation of being a very sweet individual. One night, Rabbi Dolgan wakes him up at 3 a.m. He goes, "Rabbi, it's 3 a.m. Why are you knocking at my door? Why are you waking me up?" Rabbi Dolgan says, "The food industry drop-off is at 4 a.m. There's a guy there who I know will give us a check if I meet him there first thing in the morning. Let's go over to him and go meet him." What that story tells you is that Rabbi Dolgan was a mover and shaker. He made things happen. He went to go do things. He got his congregation involved in helping him with those projects, in making those things happen. He wasn't afraid to speak his mind. There's a great story I was told about Gabe Elias. I don't know if anybody knows Gabe Elias, Rabbi Gabe Elias from Magen David, who were going to do one of the shirim at that shul. Gabe Elias was the head honcho of a young chevra in shul. He was the guy in a young chevra at shul. And he was sitting in the back of shul, you know, schmoozing, as all the shuls we remember, what do the young guys do in shul? If they're in shul, they're in the back corner schmoozing. It was always, the corner of Shartzvila was always the hot zone. I always say, if someone should have just sat, a rabbi should just park themselves in the corner of these shuls where the young guys are sitting, and they would have had shuls that could have sustained themselves for 50, 60 years filled with young people. And Rabbi, you know, so he's schmoozing in the back, and they started to leave as the sermon was going, which young people do. They get up, and they start to walk up as the sermon is starting. Rabbi Dolgan screams out in front of the whole shul, "Gabe, sit down!" In front of the whole shul. A few days later, Rabbi Dolgan calls him to his office and says, "I apologize for doing that, but I know they all see you as the leader, and I thought this would work." Gabe turns to him and says, I told him, "Thank you, Rabbi, I appreciate it." So Rabbi Dolgan was contrite, but back to Little Caesar, Rabbi Dolgan turns and says, "By the way, you walked in with muddy shoes. Go get the mop from the closet and sweep up the floor before you leave." Oh, so he was tough love. People loved him, and he was tough. He spoke his mind, and I think he was a perfect personality for the time.
Was that Joe Simon you mentioned? Is he the same one from Ventura?
No.
No.
No, it's another one.
Okay. Thank
yeah,
you.
No.
Just a little anecdote written up by his daughter. Beautiful story. How it was the Seder night, 1952. We were crowded in our not too small dining room on Harcourt Avenue in the West Adams neighborhood of Los Angeles. At the table were our own family, my parents, and four daughters. And Rabbi Dolgan was upset. We asked why. He said he realizes there are so many people in our Beth Jacob community who don't know how to make a proper Seder. Next year we're going to make a communal Seder. And I think if you think about it in Los Angeles, I don't know if there was one prior to this. It could be the conservative movement was doing it, but I don't know. I don't know of one, at least in the Orthodox movement. Rabbi Dolgan did the first one. He had the cantor come out as well, and they used that as the first public Seder at this shul. And what happened was his daughter mentions that she took the Afikoman and she hid it, and her father couldn't find it, so she gets the Afikoman present. Her father said, "What do you want?" She said, "I want my driver's permit at 16, mm-hmm. Right? Which was then the law. You get 16, you get your driver's permit. He said, "No, you're too young. You cannot have it. You're too young." A couple months later, she's meeting in the house with Rabbi Simcha Wasserman, the great Gadol of Los Angeles, who we're going to get to at another point. Rabbi Wasserman is waiting there to meet with Rabbi Dolgin, who is running late. Rabbi Dolgin comes in with a big smile on his face. 2 months later, he found the Afikomen behind some Svarim on a shelf in Beth Jacob, and he showed it to his daughter that he found it, and she got the driver's permit nonetheless, even without the finding of the Afikomen. So really, just these small stories, nostalgic stories, but just to clue you in into this Beth Jacob, into who it is. His supporters at the beginning were individuals like Manny Stern, Douglas Klein, who is actually Bernie Malamud's father-in-law, Maurice Kandel. He was always loved by the Shul overall, was always loved. He left on his own choice. He left when he was ready to go and when he was ready to move on to Israel and build Beth Jacob in Ramat Eshkol. He was close with Rabbi Jacob Levine. He was close with Rabbi Jacob Levine. He was close as well even with Rabbi Magnum. Even though he had his outspoken differences with the Reform and Conservative movement, the Dolgin family say they know their father had a relationship with Rabbi Magnum here in L.A., who I said was really the rabbinic figure for Jews here in L.A., whether you're Orthodox, Conservative, or Reform. For a period in time, he was your spokesman. He was the one who was speaking out on behalf of causes and standing up for Jews here in L.A. Let's talk about Hillel. Let's talk about Hillel. The first principal of Hillel was a man by the name of Mr. Harry Shapiro. Where did Mr. Harry Shapiro come from? He was Rabbi Dolgin's teacher in Chicago. Rabbi Dolgin really pushed the Hillel piece because he understood that if we're going to survive here in Los Angeles, it's not just the synagogues. It's going to need something more. Beth Jacob got a little boost as well. For as I said, B'nai Kiva hovered between Beth Jacob and Anshe Emes. The head of it was a man by the name of Shalom Bienenfeld, who was married to Shirley Dolgin's niece. So a lot of the stories are crisscrossing and intertwining. He was a president of Mizrahi, by the way. Now, Cantor Binyamin Glickman, also one of the famous stories in the history of Beth Jacob. Beth Jacob is going to have many famous individuals as chazanim. You have Cantor Binyamin Glickman, you have Cantor Pini Rabinowitz, you're going to have, of course, the beloved Avshalom Katz, who taught in this crosses us back over to Yeshiva Yavna, and also to Hillel Beth Jacob. You have Cantor Glickman, who was elected to join the Shirat Yerushalayim, the director of the Great Jerusalem Center for Jewish Music. He's going to go on to great things. He becomes a cantor in Stamford, Connecticut in 1992. He comes back to Los Angeles, and we know that he eventually marries the former Rebbetzin Weiss. He ends up marrying Cantor Glickman and then is invited back to Yerushalayim to head up a new singing project. Was really a hero here in Los Angeles. One of the great stories I heard of L.A. Great story. What happened was, I believe it was 1967. It makes sense, it was 1967. And war was breaking out in Yerushalayim. And what happened was Rabbi Dolgin wanted people who were willing to get up and go to stand by their Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael in Israel. Who was going to go? And one of the representatives of B'nai Kiva at the time said they can't go then. And Cantor Glickman said, I'm going. I'm the one going up. And they remember they got rid of this B'nai Kiva representative. How could you, the B'nai Kiva representative, not go? And Cantor Glickman went himself to be there. Cantor Glickman was always a very strong religious Zionist, which was a clear theme, a clear undertone for Beth Jacob, and still is a very important piece of Beth Jacob here today. What style of rabbi was Rabbi Dolgin? He was a very learned person. He had a doctorate from USC. A Yadin Yadin Smicha from Chicago. Education was exceptionally important to him. All his children have advanced degrees. It was without question. And he was a community rabbi. His day wasn't spent so much in paskening shilas, but his day was spent in servicing the community. That's the kind of rabbi he was over here in Los Angeles. Let's move on. We're running out of time, and I want to cover so much. Another principal at the early days of Hillel, people don't realize this, was Rabbi Uri. Rabbi Uri was a principal in Hillel. He was with the Board of Jewish Education. He would come and visit classes. People remember this older figure coming in and stand up, a very esteemed-looking figure. He came from Russia, and he was a very straight, very Ehrlich individual here in Los Angeles. And he would first start as the principal of Hillel. He stopped because of this offer with the Bureau of Jewish Education, the BJE. they figured that much more important for him is for him to be sort of the pseudo principal to all the schools, to go around, to make recommendations to all the schools. I don't think, I remember seeing Rabbi Uri growing up, I certainly didn't appreciate who he was, and I wonder if the previous generation did appreciate who he was, beyond just being the rabbi of Young Israel of not Beverly Hills. So here we go. This is a letter from Rav Aaron Cutler. Rav Aaron Cutler. Hineni lahakir bezeh chabibi, my good friend, harav hagon, mitsuyin becharifus ubekiyas, with tremendous sharpness and massive amounts of knowledge. Morenu harabenu Rav Zalman Uri Shlita, shalomid b'yeshiva seinu, who was with me in the yeshiva, in the Kletzky yeshiva, b'imei olamav, in its heyday. He was in the Kletzky yeshiva, where Rav Aaron Cutler developed into the great Kletzky Rosh yeshiva. Rav Uri was there. So you understand, this individual who was involved in the technicalities of education and curriculum, you're talking about a giant who really was among us. Let's continue. Rabbi Dolgin realized that he wasn't going to have time to run a school and run a shul. The school was not going to take off with Rabbi Dolgin running it because his energies were involved with the community, with the synagogue, and yes, of course, the school, but it would be too much. So, Rabbi Dolgin turns to Rabbi Fassman, the father of the current Rabbi Fassman, and he says, we're Chicago boys, right? We were in the Chicago orbit. Do we remember anybody? Is there somebody that's being recommended from the Chicago world? So they said, there's somebody who got smicha in Chicago, but he's now teaching, he's a melamed in Miami. He's not an administrator. He hasn't run anything yet. But he's a very talented young mechanech with a Torah umesorah hashkafa. His name is Rabbi Gottesman. Rav Kreisworth was the Rebbe of Rav Gottesman. Kreisworth is a major Rav in New York. And they saw Rav Kreisworth, the family saw Rav Kreisworth, and he said, they turned to him when they were unsure whether they should take the job, the Gottesmans. They want us to run a school. Should we take this, Rebbe? We've never run a school in our lives. We've never done anything like this. Rav Kreisworth said, you take it, you're going to learn on the job. And Rabbi Gottesman surely learned on the job. He came in as the educational director. He comes into a building in the lower level of Beth Jacob. Fridge was broken. There was maybe a couple pieces of broken chalk on the floor. They wanted to take a loan to be able to build the school. He said, no way. We're not going to be able to pay back this loan. We're going to be swallowed, you know, just swallowed. And he knew this from Miami, that the day school in Miami was suffering from paying back loans. And he said, the only answer, instead of paying back loans, is to go find the money. And that's where Rabbi Gottesman became really one of the legends, as far as rabbis are concerned, Los Angeles is concerned, as a fundraising legend. Rabbi Gottesman turned to Rabbi Dolgin on one occasion. Rabbi Dolgin used to, like I said, Rabbi Dolgin went to the fish market at 4 a.m. to go fundraise. He was also a fundraiser. But Rabbi Gottesman created an entire paradigm shift of how you look at fundraising for day schools here in Los Angeles. Rabbi Gottesman turned to Rabbi Dolgin on one occasion and said, why are we setting up these meetings and we're asking for $25? Well, we're asking for $25, it doesn't cost us any money more to ask for $100, to ask for $1,000, to ask for $3,000. It doesn't hurt us. Rabbi Dolgin said that the Talmud outdid the Rebbe, that the student, Rabbi Gottesman, outshined him in this area. And Rabbi Gottesman said that we thought we were only going to be there for 1 year. And his wife said, Rabbi Gottesman told me, our family's motto was always 1 year at a time. 1 year at a time was our family's motto. And that's how they moved forward 1 year after the other. She was an interesting figure here in Los Angeles. By the way, she was one of the first to cover her hair in Los Angeles. You know, many communities, certainly ones that developed as offshoots from Western Europe and as Eastern Europeans were coming later on, many people just simply, covering hair was not on the radar at that time in Los Angeles. She was...
Silberstein's wife, they're not...
I think from my research, it seems no. It seems no. Now, then again, there were famous rabbinical figures, whose wives did not cover their hair around. I don't have to go through the list. You can Google it, and I'm sure bloggers have posted the list. They love that stuff. Bloggers have posted the list. But it's interesting that they were. I'm telling you this because they looked like outsiders. And right away, Rabbi Gottesman found his way in. The big donors at the beginning are some names like Gluck and Spiegel, Arnall, Ives. Arnall and Ives were partners. The Samson is going to be a very active member, the head of the youth. He's going to be in charge of the youth of the shul. You have Eliza Slomovic, who's going to be in charge of education at Beth Jacob. And you have someone by the name of Avram Tabash, who was president for 20 years.
Yeah.
Was president for 20 years. And his son, Edward Tabash, who has his own Wikipedia entry. That's a madrigo when you get to the level of Wikipedia entry. By the way, Tabash is Tabachnik, which ties us back into Rabbi Summers and their family as well. But Tabash was an Orthodox, his father was an Orthodox rabbi, grandfather from Lithuania, family going back, and he's a lawyer, was a lawyer in Beverly, major lawyer, constitutional lawyer in Beverly Hills, famous for debating many. Involved in Hillel, many people are involved in building the school. You have people, Emil Fish, who comes in a few years after, but you have Ben Jacobowitz, Harry Grossman. Many people are going to step up to help. They're going to ones who run the banquets. They're going to send their kids over to Hillel. They're going to send their kids over to Hillel.
This is in the current Beth Jacob building that they have now, you're saying?
This was in the basement of the current Beth Jacob, and then soon in, they put a property a block down, which is the connection to this... to the building we're in right now. Connection to the hill we're in right now. You have the Lynn family, who are the first ones to start an endowment for the hill for the Hillel school. You know the Lynn. Ethel and Milton Lynn.
Milton
Lynn.
We would go visit her.
What?
Some of the girls would go visit
her. Go visit Mrs. Lynn.
No, at the time.
You're going to have Samuel Fryer. That's one of the most incredible stories. Samuel Fryer's story, I'm not going to get to this week. I'm going to get to next Wednesday night. It is one of the most incredible stories, how Samuel Fryer got to these day schools and how his names was on the day schools. A story you're not going to believe. How did the money come to Rabbi Gottesman? And this is, I'm telling you this, not about the money. I'm telling you this because this created the identity of Hillel. Rabbi Gottesman didn't care how much you had when it came to getting a Jewish education. Rabbi Gottesman treated you like gold. And that was the irony at all. He knew how to get money, but he didn't look and check whether you're a money person before letting you in the school. You were in the school unconditionally because you needed a Jewish education. Those families that were let in, who couldn't afford to pay even a dollar for tuition, were the ones who were going to become Rabbi Gottesman's big donors. When you talk about families who made it a little later on, the Harkams consider themselves forever dedicated to Rabbi Gottesman and his family. Such hakaras hatov that they have. And they also, I believe, were in the shmata business, which we talked about, Jews in the shmata business we talked about last week. Uri Harkam is the one who's going to come up with the idea of building a home here in L.A. for the teachers. Let's build a quadruplex. It's a great idea. No one thought like that. How are you going to bring in great mechanchim instead of recycling the same people? Let's build a complex right near the shul where we could bring in multiple people, multiple teachers who could stay there. You could house the chazan. You can get a great group. That's going to build the early stages of Hillel. Hillel is going to be the school at the beginning. It will be a place that collects all Jews. It has a wide range. To this day, the inclusiveness of Hillel is still one of its great markers. Is still one of its great markers, even to 2014. We'll continue back to Hillel in a moment. After Rabbi Dolgan leaves to Israel, he's followed by Rabbi Maurice Lam. Those who were staunch Rabbi Dolgan supporters didn't exactly find their place perfectly with Rabbi Lam. Once you have a great rabbi for 20 years, it's very hard to see anybody after that who will ever be the same. And from Rabbi Dolgan afterwards, to the merge to Rabbi Lam was difficult. But Rabbi Lam built his reputation on a new chevra. He built his reputation on an entirely new and young chevra. Young individuals who are now some of the individuals who are leading the congregation in Beth Jacob as we speak. And that's the ones who became his chevra. A lawyer from Century City. What's his name? The son is now runs Ora, getting the get organization. Jeremy Stern's father. Stern and individuals like that. They surrounded Rabbi Lam. They loved Rabbi Lam. Yes, he was known also partially for his brother Rabbi Norman Lam. But Rabbi Maurice Lam brought to the table some very big talents, and that was that was his activism. And activism was a big deal for Beth Jacob at this point in time. When you talk about Beth Jacob in the 1970s, Rabbi Lam was very strong on Soviet Jewry, picketing the Bolshevik ballet. the what are you called? Bolshevik ballet, not the Bolstoy ballet. The Bolsheviks. The Bolshoi ballet, not the Bolsheviks. Wrong one. So they all got involved. They all got involved. He was a very dynamic speaker. Very dynamic. He was an army chaplain, and he taught the Jews to have a connection to Thanksgiving, 4th of July, Memorial Day, which are forgotten days in the Los Angeles Jewish calendar. No shuls do anything much over here, and Rabbi Lam really tried to make that connection happen. What happened was, at a certain point, and this is a side history which we're going to get to, is a group of individuals, for whatever reason, don't like the style that Beth Jacob has become. They don't like the style. It's too big. It's too ceremonial. It's too sermonic. It's too synagogue-y. We want something smaller, more intimate, perhaps what they would even call more religious. More religious. They're going to break away and create Young Israel of Century City. The irony of it all is that Young Israel of Century City itself produces offshoots from it, people who will say, we want something more small, more intimate, more religious. This is the syndrome of Judaism. Jews. Nothing's ever Jews. It's never Jews. Good enough. We always need something more, and we keep moving, and we keep shifting, and we keep shifting. And that's the irony that we see, the irony that we found nowadays. But Beth Jacob is a prosperous community. It's a very strong community. Rabbi Lam comes in 1972. He's going to leave in the mid-80s. One of the important moments, I'm going to tell you this right now, some good history. After Rabbi Lam is leaving, it's time for the provost for a new rabbi.
Why did he leave?
Rabbi Lam wanted to get involved in YU. He wanted to become connected. He was raising money, actually, here in L.A. for a chair over in YU. Right, over in YU. He went into other fields, academic.
Hospice.
Hospice as well. Right, the YU piece did not work out. He went for YU, and the YU piece did not work out. Okay, very interesting piece here. Earl Korchak, we mentioned the Valley, right? A very important, interesting piece of history happens in Earl Korchak's house. What happens is that there needs to be an interview for a new rabbi at Beth Jacob. So they decide to hold an interview for a young rabbi in Earl Korchak's home. The rabbi tries out, a young British rabbi tries out, and he doesn't get the job. I've seen the letter of him not getting the job. You may know him. His name is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, former chief rabbi of England. He tried out for the Beth Jacob job in Earl Korchak's house. Rabbi Abner Weiss had a chevra following of South Africans in the community who wanted to see their boy in the shul. History is a funny thing, the way it plays out. You know, if Rabbi Jonathan Sacks would have gotten the job Beth Jacob, he may never have gone on to become the chief rabbi of England and gone on to write all those amazing things, because the job description is just different. To Beth Jacob, you're very communal-oriented. And it's interesting why things happen the way they do and the way history progresses. Rabbi Weiss, for many years, was known as the orator in Los Angeles. You wanted a great sermon in L.A., you went to hear Rabbi Abner Weiss. He could make the phone book sound like it was the most moving thing in the world. Rabbi Weiss, within the shul, it went in some interesting directions. Rabbi Weiss got very involved in Kabbalah. You'll see some of his audio shiurim online in Kabbalah and different forms of psychology and Kabbalah. The match got strange within the shul. Let's call it that. The shidduch got strange within the shul, and it was moving away from the old style of what Beth Jacob was used to. Rabbi Weiss, importantly, also was going to become the heir to the Beit Din of Rav Katz. Rav Katz, I mentioned last week, was the go-to person to write a get if you needed one in L.A. His student who trained under him was Rabbi Abner Weiss. Rabbi Abner Weiss was not going to be part of the RCC. He was his own Beit Din under Rav Katz. So the story ends the way it ends for Rabbi Abner Weiss here at the shul, and it's also an interesting twist. And ultimately, one ending of a chapter brings always about a new renewal and a rebirth. And that's the era of Rabbi Stephen Weil, a game changer, not just for L.A., but for, I think, Jewry in America as a whole. Yes?
How did it end with Rabbi Weiss?
Rabbi Weiss goes to Jews College. I'll say this. Rabbi Weiss goes to Jews College for 2 years. He gets hired by Marble Arch. That evolves into something else entirely and makes way for ultimately Rabbi Weil to step in. The assistant rabbi at Beth Jacob at the time, Rabbi Joshua Berkowitz, is going to move over to Shari Tfilah, which we're going to get to next week. Rabbi Abner Weiss is going to be followed by Rabbi Stephen Weil. Probably one of the most interesting, is the word I would use, interesting rabbis, in one of the most interesting rabbis in the history of Los Angeles. It's very hard to pin down Rabbi Weil entirely. From all the rabbis we've spoken about in L.A., you could very clearly define and understand that identity. He's someone who loves to learn, loves the teachings of Rav Soloveitchik. He loves to schmooze. He loves to meet with people. He's extremely successful at fundraising. We're talking about levels beyond even what Rabbi Gottesman had achieved. And people who are professionals relate to him. They connect to him. The young professionals minion at Beth Jacob really starts and gets going because of Rabbi Weil. Rabbi Weil deals with the issues that we're facing at the time. In the 90s, Rabbi Weil is dealing with those issues head on with intermarriage. He doesn't turn those Jews away who are on the fringe. That doesn't bother him. The Jews who have come out, the Jews who have intermarried, whatever category. Rabbi Weil's able to speak that because of his background. Rabbi Weil himself is a Baal Tshuva and is able to speak the language, but what makes him unique is his level of learning has surpassed that of one who is sort of coming from a Baal Tshuva background, because he is so enamored by the world of lumdus and analysis, making, again, Rabbi Weil a very interesting figure. Rabbi Weil ends up, because he's outspoken, very much like in the tradition of Rabbi Dolgin, Rabbi Weil is what you call a Baal Shita. He speaks up for what he believes in, like Rabbi Dolgin as well. Both figures, I think, perhaps the most, you know, memorable until that point in Beth Jacob's history because of their outspokenness. And that gets them both into a few controversies, which I don't think takes away from who they are, but on the contrary, makes those figures larger than life. You're not going to read the biography of Churchill without reading in there how many people were ticked off because of Churchill, and the great ones always, in a sense, have that as well. Afterwards, they go to their current movement Rabbi Kalman Topp comes in from Long Island, who's the rabbi today. We're going to get to the current state of the rabbinate all the way at the end, talk about the rabbis right now in the scene and where all the movements are in L.A. and where L.A. is headed. But I don't want to leave that saying that Rabbi Topp, a wonderful person, a good friend of mine, and a great fit, and someone who is shovel l'chol nefesh, someone who knows how to get along with everybody.
How many years was Rabbi
Weil? I don't know. I have to check. We get him. 9 years? It was 9 years?
9 years.
Okay. I want to say one more piece, going back to the Hillel piece. For what defines Hillel, and we're in Hillel, and it's important to say this, Rabbi Dolgin makes this point. Rabbi Dolgin pens a very important essay, which I saw a snippet of it is in one of those articles you had there, called The Personal Equation, The Determinant in Jewish Education. And he writes an analysis of where Jewish education is right now. But his bottom line conclusion, which is, now it seems like it's of course. But at that point, it was a new idea, and to this day, we still can't do it well, even though it's obvious. Hebrew is called Lashon Kadosh. Because it is the sacred language, it needs a sacred style. All the modern methodologies of education will not change the fact that it's about the personal equation, relating to each individual. These teachers of the new school are unable to impart the vibrancy and sanctity of Jewish life to their students, as were those of the old school. And he's talking about a new hybrid. A hybrid of someone who is modernized, who is educated, who is who is well-versed, who's academic. But at the same time, although he has his foot in the modern world because he has a modern language, he's steeped in the tradition and he's warm and he's engaging. And that's how we're going to reach our students. That's the vision. What he's laying down is a framework for modern orthodoxy in Los Angeles. That's essentially what he's laying down. He's saying the old schools are not going to work. It's not what we need. And newfangled, new dynamic, chucking everything out is not going to work either. What we need is a fusion of being able to take the best of modernity with the warmth and the vibrancy of Torah and the Morasha Kehilas Yaakov. That's how we're going to have Judaism. And that legacy of Rabbi Dolgin, which was imparted over to Rabbi Gottesman, which was well imparted over to Hillel's current principal. Without a doubt, Rabbi Suffren, one of the warmest rabbis I know, one of the warmest heads of school. Heads of schools are usually tough. Rabbi Suffren is a warm individual carrying on the tradition of that belief of Rabbi Dolgin, that the children need a positive example in their Judaism, a warm, embracing Judaism that's also steeped in a modern education. And that really is the message of Hillel. The interesting thing is Miami is the provider one more time, as Rabbi Suffren, who is a native of England, was a rabbi of a school and a shul in Miami, and he's going to be brought over here to Hillel. He creates a great relationship with Rabbi Weil, thus re-cementing the Beth Jacob-Hillel relationship. Rabbi Weil's going to help with some of the fundraising elements. Together they're going to help on bringing out some talent into Hillel, into rejuvenating Hillel to make it once again a cutting-edge school that it is. And the beloved figure that Rabbi Suffren is goes hand in hand with the tough stance of Rabbi Weil at that time. So that was the history of Beth Jacob and Hillel. There's so much more to say, but we can only do as much as we can in the time we have. God willing, this coming Wednesday night at Anshei Emes, I'll be speaking about Shari Tfilah, Yavna, and I have two knockout stories that are really about two side stories that are really earth-shattering. We'll get to that next week.
Oh, yeah.